It's 10 o'clock.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Farm and Country. I'm your host, Kimberly Izar. Happy Saturday. It is May 23rd. Well, Trout Release Day in Calicoon Creek Park brought a group of Sullivan West students to release young trout into the waters. Rosie Starr has that story. We chat with Ulster County historian Eddie Moran about his recent trip to Ontario, Canada, to reconnect with Lenape and other Indigenous descendants. Plus, an update on how small farmers are navigating cuts to federal food access programs, and growing tourism at Catterskill Falls prompts potential changes to visitors' management. Well, as I said, we are live in the studio today because it is our music yard sale happening right now until 3 p.m. in Liberty. We have so much stuff. We'll get an update from Radio Catskill's Jason Dole. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is in India for high-level talks aimed at strengthening economic and security ties between the two countries. During a meeting with Prime Minister Narendra Modi today, Rubio highlighted growing cooperation between Washington and New Delhi.
We've expanded commercial ties now with more than $20 billion in investments. $20 billion in investments from Indian companies in the United States. We've deepened a security partnership through military exercises in the Indo-Pacific. And of course, as part of that, we recognize that an orderly and a secure consular system is vital to solidifying this important relationship.
The two countries are also discussing tensions involving Iran. The trip comes on the heels of a visit to Sweden on Friday, where Rubio met with NATO foreign ministers. The Trump administration has tightened rules to apply for a green card. NPR's Jasmine Guards reports temporary visa holders must now return to their home countries and apply from there.
In the past, visa holders have been able to file for an adjustment of status in the U.S. and in many cases stay while it was pending. The memo reiterates that visa holders looking to get a green card, which is a permanent residency, must apply from their home countries. People like international students or skilled workers with H-1B visas. In the memo, United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, or USCIS, said the pathway to permanent residency has been abused for decades. And that people who are denied or in waiting sometimes stay illegally. Immigration advocates say it would place people fleeing dangerous circumstances in vulnerable positions in which they'd have to return to that danger. Jasmine Garst, NPR News, New York.
Search and rescue operations are underway in northern China after an explosion at a coal mine left at least 90 people dead. NPR's Jennifer Pack reports an investigation into what caused the blast is underway.
The gas explosion happened after 7 p.m. on Friday at a coal mine in northern China's Shanxi province. State media on Saturday initially reported there were 247 people on duty underground and that the majority were brought out safely with only 8 deaths. It did not explain why the death toll has jumped. Chinese leader Xi Jinping called for a thorough investigation and said those responsible should be held accountable. China has a history of industrial accidents, but it has reduced the number in recent years with stricter rules and safer practices. Shanxi province is known as China's main coal mining province. It produces almost a third of China's coal each year. Jennifer Pak, NPR News, Shanghai.
This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Kimberly Izar. New York State legislators approved another portion of the state budget package Thursday, and it includes new restrictions on how local enforcement cooperates with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. Samuel King with the New York Public News Network has more on the funding bill and why some are opposed.
The legislation would prohibit agreements between local law enforcement and ICE and allow people to sue ICE for constitutional and civil rights violations in state courts. Would also forbid local and state government workers from cooperating with ICE, but law enforcement would still be able to contact ICE if someone is suspected of a crime. State Senator Andrew Gonardis, a Brooklyn Democrat, says that means the bill wouldn't go far enough to prevent cases like that of Nurul Amin Shah Alam, a Buffalo refugee who died after being released from immigration custody.
I think 95% of what is in this package is very, very strong, and I'm happy to celebrate it. But we've done nothing to prevent another case like Nurul Alam's from happening.
Republicans like Assemblymember Jared Gandolfo of Long Island say the bill would make New Yorkers less safe.
We are setting ourselves up for some real problems in the future.
Lawmakers return Tuesday to consider the rest of the state budget. In Albany, I'm Samuel King for the New York Public News Network.
The immigration protections in the budget bill fall short of the full New York for All Act sought by advocates. Legislators say they'll spend the final 2 weeks of the session pushing for stronger protections that get closer to the full bill that they say Governor Kathy Hochul has resisted. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org.
Welcome back to Farm and Country. I'm Kimberly Izar. And as I mentioned at the top of the hour, today's a special morning because we are live in the studio for a very special reason. It's Radio Catskill's Music Yard Sale, and it's happening right now here in our studios in Liberty. Joining me in the studio to talk a little bit more about the sale is Radio Catskill's Jason Dole.
Howdy,
hello.
Howdy, gotta turn that mic on. How you doing? Yeah, yeah.
How's it going?
It's going good. In fact, you hear that bell?
Yes, I do.
Listen, you know what? The music sale is happening right now. It's going until 3 o'clock this afternoon. Oh, there's another one.
That's
a record you wanted that somebody else just bought. Oh, no, there's another one. Boy, you got to get out here before they all go. We've got tons of great stuff, and not just records. The CD selection just keeps getting better every sale. I might be a bit biased because I think it's my generation that's kind of like giving up their record, their CD collections now, and that's why we're seeing a lot of that. But it's really cool CDs, but the records are really cool too, and people are here and buying. And I don't know if you noticed, it's rainy for a major holiday weekend where people often like to do things outdoors.
Inside.
Our sale's inside. So if there's things that you were thinking of doing outside this weekend around the area in the beautiful Catskills, and maybe you've had to modify your plans, especially today's going to be rainier than tomorrow, today's a perfect day to come over because our yard sale's indoors.
And, you know, Jason, you've been doing these sales for quite some time. I mean, I feel like this sale, especially I pulled into the parking lot and it was packed already. What do you feel like this sale, does it feel a little different than previous years?
Everyone is different. And it's a steady turnout, but I had the same experience. I came, it was like before like the sale even opened, and once again there's like cars in the parking lot, there's the diehards already lining up, even though this is, you know, we have our big music sale in November, and that's like what we're working towards all year, and these music yard sales are a little bit smaller, so I expect it's like, yeah, it's casual, people will come, people go, no, there's some people lined up and stuff, but there's plenty of room, and I'm in the record room, that's where I am, and there's plenty of room for people to get to the boxes and shop around. It's not like there's a mob here, it's just steady, and I hope it stays steady for the rest of the day, because the way this works is people donate their music collections to us, their records, their CDs, their stereo equipment, their instruments. The community, it comes from the community, and then we sell it back to the community to fund public radio to serve the community. So I want you to be part of that circle. It's a beautiful circle. Be part of it in whatever way you can. We're right here on Route 52 in Liberty, New York. It's happening at our studios. If you come out in the main building on the porch, that's where we got the CDs. We have a big dry porch. In the inside is where we've got the vinyl records. But don't miss the building right next door, our white building. That's where we have this beautiful, it's like a store of like high-end hi-fi equipment and instruments. We just refurbished the space, and our dedicated volunteer Kenny has done an amazing job getting those turntables looking gorgeous. So especially if you're looking for like a high-end turntable, vintage, we've got those, and they're working.
Yeah, we got it all. Well, come on down. It's happening right now until 3 o'clock. It's all inside. You're not going to get wet. Jason, thanks so much for coming
in. Thanks for having me.
Well, the Trump administration announced the Farmer Bridge Assistance Program to assist commodity and specialty growers from the president's trade war. But small farmers aren't waiting until the funds arrive. We're airing a recent segment that originally aired on Marketplace on May 12 that featured the story of Finca Seremos, a local Sullivan County farm.
At the end of last year, the Trump administration announced a $12 billion bailout package for U.S. farmers who were suffering from the president's trade war. $11 billion of that total is for commodity producers. These are the farms that grow thousands of acres of corn or soy or wheat or cotton, mainly to ship overseas. The remaining billion is set aside for farmers the USDA calls specialty growers. They produce fruits and vegetables and everything else. They are not caught in the crosshairs of the trade war the way commodity farmers are. But as H. Connolly reports, they have plenty to still worry about domestically.
We're talking about smaller farms. Maybe they have some sheep and a few chickens. They grow cabbages, tomatoes, lettuce, onions, peppers, okra. Finca Seremos is a farm like that in upstate New York.
If you can grow it in this climate and it's an annual vegetable, chances are we grow it. So we've got a crop list of about 40 different crops and about 200 different varieties.
Chris Nickel is hoping to make $140,000 selling those vegetables this year. Most of that income is from a sliding scale CSA, or Community Supported Agriculture Project. The rest comes from selling wholesale to food pantries and mutual aid groups. Or came from, because the administration has slashed the food access programs that support them.
We've lost about $12,000 that we were planning on from a partner in the city that was relying on a federal program that got cut to pay for our food for their food pantry.
Then there are cuts to SNAP and nutrition incentive programs.
So in total, about 20% of our budget is in limbo, and that's not insubstantial.
Nickel applied for aid through the bailout program, and they found it a pain. It was designed for commodity growers who can say, I grow 400 acres of corn that I sell to this silo. It's so much more complicated for Finca Seremos.
I am telling them that the acreage ranged from 0.02 acres for, I believe it was celery, all the way up to 0.1 or 0.15 acres for things that we grow a lot more of, like lettuce and cabbage.
And a lot of farmers don't know their precise bed feet to calculate into fractional acres for each varietal. You get the picture. The application can take a long time. And the kicker is, farmers have no idea how much aid they'll get. The federal government has already paid out $9.6 billion to commodity growers, but the USDA hasn't even published reimbursement rates for specialty crops yet. Vanessa Garcia Polanco is with the Young Farmers Coalition.
Like, if you're going to put 40, 60 hours applying for this and you may only get $200, it's not worth it.
Based on past programs, Garcia Polanco thinks even that would take 18 months to 2 years to get paid out. Nickel's not waiting on that money. Seedlings need planting and community needs cultivating.
I literally know every one of our CSA members' names and about their families, where they live, all that stuff. And it's beautiful and touching and moving and also helps me survive economically. Because of that close relationship. And that is the case for most of the farmers in this region.
Nickel relies on these relationships because they're more durable than government programs. I'm H. Conley for Marketplace.
We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, Ulster County's most recent efforts to reconnect with Lenape descendants. Stay with us.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Will-O-Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange, Sullivan, and Rockland, a publicly supported philanthropic institution. Information at CFOSRNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Welcome back to Farming Country. I'm Kimberly Izar. The Esopus people were a Lenape community native to what is now known as Ulster County before they were forcibly removed or displaced by war, colonization, and broken treaties. Ulster County has been working on reconnecting and building those relationships with Lenape and Indigenous communities. I spoke with Eddie Moran. He's the county's first full-time historian about his recent trip to Ontario, Canada, where many descendants live today, and what he learned and what he hopes comes next from this shared relationship. For folks who might not be too familiar with the Catskills and Hudson Valley's, Indigenous history, tell me more about the tribes and indigenous communities that lived here and what their relationship was like with colonial settlers.
I'd love to. So really, from Albany kind of all the way south through New York City and the western half of Long Island, east into the Housatonic River Valley in Connecticut, and west into the upper Delaware and Susquehanna River valleys, would all be inhabited for thousands of years by groups who spoke different dialects of a language that we today call Lenape. Lenape is not the word that they would have used for their language. Lenape in their language just means human. And so we use that word today to refer to the language, but it really just comes from the way that these people refer to themselves. I should mention the Lenape language is a part of the Eastern Algonquian language family. And although, and I should mention too, there are three dialects, broadly speaking, of Lenape. There is Mohican, which is primarily spoken on the east side of the Hudson River and into the Housatonic River Valley, but also spoken on both sides of the river up towards Albany and in the northern third to northern half of the Catskill Mountains. A dialect called Muncie, which is spoken really on the west side of the Hudson in the upper Delaware River Valley and Susquehanna River Valleys. And then getting further south into what's now New Jersey, parts of Pennsylvania, and even down into Delaware would have been a southern dialect called Unami. And so all these different groups, you know, they knew they spoke related languages. They, you know, maintained very close ties through trade, through intermarriage, political and military ties with one another. But they all identified very closely with the land that they particularly lived on. So there were many, many subgroups. And around the time of colonization, the people from about, if you were to draw a line east to west, about halfway, you know, up the Catskill Mountains, from there south to about what's now Newburgh, west into Sullivan County, really east up to the Hudson River, which means most of what's now Ulster County, would have been a subgroup referred to as the Esopus people. And they were likely comprised of even smaller subgroups, but they amalgamate about the time of colonization. And to give a bit of a sense of kind of their relationship with colonists here, the colonization, of course, begins with the Dutch in the very early 17th century in New York as a whole. Henry Hudson sails up our river in 1609. But it doesn't reach the mid-Hudson Valley until 1652. And in the 1650s is really when European settlers, along with enslaved people of African descent, begin settling here in the mid-Hudson Valley, originally in what's now Kingston. And at first, these two sides tried to coexist, but tensions naturally rise between the Esopus and the Dutch colonists here in Kingston. And those tensions, unfortunately, led to two very tragic wars, which were fought from 1659 to 1663. We call those the Esopus Wars. And after those wars are over, they don't just sign a ceasefire. They sign a lasting peace treaty, which really flips the relationship on its head. It says not only are we going to stop fighting, but the treaty, which we call the Nichols Treaty from 1665, it says between the two sides, we're going to commit ourselves to being friends and allies. We're going to renew this treaty every year, and we're going to bring the young people to those renewals so that they can learn the importance of this and they can carry that tradition forward. And those renewals took place for almost 100 years, from 1665 to 1776, so really over 100 years. And the American Revolution, unfortunately, really fractures that alliance. And of course, you know, I'm giving a very broad overview.
Right.
There's a more nuanced story of, you know, land sales and how their land is sold here in Ulster County in that period of alliance. But really, the revolution is the event that breaks this alliance. The Esopus people and the Catskill Mohicans end up on the British side of the war, whereas Ulster County is fervently pro-independence. And not only does that fracture that treaty and fracture this alliance, there's a guerrilla war fought on the western side of Ulster County between the Esopus people, their Haudenosaunee allies and loyalists, and our Ulster County militia. And it's the events of the revolution that directly lead to the Esopus being pushed out of New York. They are pushed out of the state to what's now Ontario, Canada, where they reside today. So they reside, their descendants, among a federally recognized tribe in Ontario called the Six Nations of the Grand River. So it's primarily a Haudenosaunee community, but it includes the descendants of the Esopus Lenape people as well.
First off, thank you so much for sharing that. I know you mentioned that it was a broad history, but but I really loved hearing you talk about the timeline. I think it's so important for people to know the history of where their homes are now. You recently traveled to Ontario, Canada, to meet with some of those descendants of the Osope and Lenape tribes who were, you know, as you described, displaced from their homes from fractured alliances, wars, colonization, and now live in Canada. Talk to me about the decision to take this trip and what was your intention and purpose for going there?
Yeah, I'd love to. So I actually had the great fortune of visiting two federally recognized tribes in Ontario, so visiting their reserves. One of which is the Munsee Delaware Nation. The other is called the Delaware Nation at Moravian Town. So they live, you know, maybe about an hour's drive from the Six Nations of the Grand River, where the Osopus descendants are. So they are very closely related descendants, but the two reservations I visited are actually primarily descendants of the Munsee speakers, so the same dialect group, but that were living in the Delaware River Valley and the Susquehanna River Valley, and, you know, further south in the Hudson River Valley as well. So it's really fascinating. These two communities, they really keep this, not just Lenape way of life, but, you know, the Munsee language and their culture alive. And they do include people who are now descendants of the Osopus, because these three communities, the Six Nations of the Grand River, where the Osopus descendants are, and the Munsee Delaware Nation and Delaware Nation at Moravian Town, because they're all within an hour of each other in Ontario, they are the same cultural group with a shared history. There's a lot of intermarriage that occurs. But the reason that I was there visiting just these two Munsee reservations and not directly visiting the reservation of the descendants of the Osopus was because, you know, as they've lived, the Osopus descendants, in a Haudenosaunee reservation, so a completely different language group, for, you know, hundreds of years now, many of their descendants have assimilated to the Haudenosaunee language and culture and to their identity somewhat. So we're proud in recent years to have, you know, made a lot of headway building relationships with the federally recognized tribes who comprise Lenape descendants as a whole. There are also federally recognized tribes descended from the Lenape in Oklahoma and Wisconsin. But the kind of next step we are aspiring to is to build a more direct relationship with the Osopus descendants on the Six Nations of the Grand River. And I should mention that, you know, this visit really came about because I was fortunate to kind of cut my teeth, so to speak, in the history world at a museum down in New Paltz, historic Huguenot Street, where they, for, you know, years now, I mean, going back to the late 2000s, they had been building a relationship with these federally recognized Lenape tribes. And so, you know, when I was just a young tour guide, first getting started there in college, and then later I had the great opportunity to work there full time, I could kind of, you know, get introduced to them. I could see that relationship building process between this one nonprofit occurring. And, you know, when I had the privilege of being appointed Ulster County historian, I kind of saw that as my chance to make more of an impact on my own. You know, I was fortunate to have the connections with these Lenape folks. I was really fortunate to make those connections through my time at Huguenot Street and then carry them over to Ulster County. So this was a trip that was organized actually by a Lenape women's group, which involves members of all five of the federally recognized Lenape tribes. And that women's group involves a lot of living historians who work with historic Huguenot Street down in New Paltz. So this trip was really, I think they were looking at it as a chance for, you know, them to not just continue building these relationships, but give their allies in their homelands a chance to come and see their communities today and learn more about them in the present tense.
Yeah, I mean, wow, that sounds like such an incredible trip.
Thank you. It was.
And I, you know, I'd love to hear, you know, for you, as I know you mentioned you're the first full-time historian for the county, how are you thinking about how this trip shapes the future of your work?
Yeah, well, I mentioned that the Osopus descendants, and I should say the Catskill Mohican descendants as well, who are, you know, this Delaware, this Lenape subgroup, and I should have mentioned Delaware is, you know, another name used for the Lenape people. They're this Lenape subgroup, but on a Haudenosaunee reservation, you know, having assimilated somewhat to Haudenosaunee culture. The two Munsee communities that I visited, they're actually doing, to a degree, the same kind of relationship building with the Osopus descendants, you know, because they're doing their own cultural and language revitalization efforts, their own historic preservation efforts, they are conducting outreach right now to the Esopus descendants and Catskill Mohican descendants on the Six Nations of the Grand River, trying to teach them more about their Lenape ancestry, trying to teach them the Muncie language. And so, you know, that's kind of one hope, is that we can, now that, you know, we've managed to build a relationship with these two Muncie communities, that we can combine our efforts and, you know, we can work with them in doing that outreach to the Esopus' descendants. And, you know, we hope to one day not just cultivate opportunities for them to return to their homelands, both for, you know, reasons of education, of viewing historic sites, of really incorporating their feedback and perspective in public history, but also just so that they can, you know, return and engage with their homelands however they want. We also kind of have the lofty goal, which likely, you know, is years off, but we're aspiring to eventually actually renew that 1665 Nichols Treaty again with the Esopus' descendants. Technically, that treaty should still be in place. And it, you know, if it was to be renewed, would once again kind of form a close alliance between our county and between this community. But, you know, it's been, I'm trying to do the math, you know, 250 years now.
It's been a minute.
Yeah, 250 years since that was last renewed. And so what an incredible opportunity that would be.
Yeah, and I'm just curious, you know, what would renewing a treaty like that mean exactly?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. I think it can mean a lot of different things. You know, I mean, in one sense, I mentioned, I think it means, you know, us supporting them in having a platform here in their homelands, you know, making sure that when we're teaching about history, when we're preserving history, you know, if development is taking place that might affect historic sites or might affect, you know, the archaeological record, that their perspectives, that their guidance, their wishes are fully incorporated. You know, any understanding of local history, especially Native history, it's going to be incomplete without incorporating their perspectives and their lived experience. But I also think it means somewhat us trying to right some of the wrongs of the past. You know, for this Treaty of Friendship and Alliance, I think to really mean something, I think it would involve not just, you know, us bringing their descendants back here to teach and to educate, but, you know, us trying to allow them opportunities to return to their homelands, to engage with their homelands however they see fit, you know, be that spiritually, be that, you know, engaging with the environment. I think, you know, incorporating more of their perspectives on environmental stewardship is greatly important. And I think just as much, you know, only kind of vague ideas of it for now, but, you know, I hope one day that we can also try and help them in facing some of the challenges that they face today as a direct result of colonization and their removal from their homelands. You know, they don't just necessarily get to their new homes and have a completely peaceful, positive experience long afterward. You know, they're still facing challenges today, as many Native communities living on reservations are facing today. And so I hope that we can also, you know, be providing some level of support as they still grapple with the consequences of colonization too.
Yeah, definitely very exciting and important work. That,
yeah. And, you know, I guess, too, I'm sorry to cut
you off.
You mentioned land back also being a lofty goal, hopefully one time in the future as well.
Yeah.
That's something that's taken place up by Albany, actually, with the Mohican descendants, the Stockbridge Muncie community in Wisconsin. There's been land returned to them in both Massachusetts and here in the Hudson Valley. And so, you know, we have an example, I think, to follow there as well.
Well, Eddie, before we sign off, just anything that you want folks to know about that you're working on?
Yeah, I am actually going to plug an event for a kind of allied public historic site, which I mentioned already. But on June 13th and 14th at Historic Huguenot Street in New Paltz, there is a living history event that is put on jointly between Historic Huguenot Street, Wild Hudson Valley up in Caro, and a Native living history group called Caesars Ford Theater from Ohio. And this event is called the New Netherland Marketplace, and it's a living history event where half of Huguenot Street are set up with craftspeople representing European colonists, representing African colonists, and showing the type of skills and life ways that they practiced here. But the other half of the street, Historic Huguenot Street, pays to bring back enrolled members of the Lenape tribes. And it's a chance for folks for free to not just meet enrolled members of these Lenape communities, but learn from them about their culture, learn from them about their history, ask whatever questions you would like. And so again, that's June 13th and 14th on Huguenot Street in DuPont. It's a free event, and I really encourage everyone to check it out.
Oh, that sounds so much fun.
Yeah, it's great. You know, it's always better when the Lenape folks are given a chance to, you know, tell their own story. I'm very proud to, you know, get to build greater recognition of their history, their experience, and, you know, their presence today. But it's always better when you can meet them and talk to them in person.
Thanks so much to Eddie Moran for that conversation. We're going to take a short break, but coming up, the latest Star Talk report from the stars. Stay with us.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Flax Fiber Farm, creating embroidery kits representing common invasive plants in the Catskills. Made from New York farm-grown wool felt, dyed with plants and one special bug, and containing embroidery instructions and useful guides for identifying and managing invasive species. FlaxFiberFarm.com. From generous funding from Press Forward, closing local coverage gaps. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org. Support for Radio Catskill comes from Tavern on Main, where modern American cuisine meets classic favorites. Dinner, weekend brunch, craft cocktails, and warm hospitality on Main Street in Jeffersonville. More at TavernOnMainNY.com.
Welcome back to Farm and Country. If you're just joining us, I'm Kimberly Izar. Happy Saturday, May 23rd. We got a special edition this morning. We're live in the studio because it's our music yard sale happening right now until 3 p.m. at our studios in Liberty. I mean, we got it all. It is really a music lover's paradise. We have vinyl, CDs, speakers, turntables. I saw a couple guitars and keyboards in the White House just by the station. Come on down over to our studios in Liberty. Would love to see you happening now until 3 p.m. Hope to see you today. Up next, you know what time it is, this week's Star Talk report from Keith Hubbard.
From Farm and Country, I'm Keith Hubbard, and this is Star Talk. Humans have been tracking the moon across the sky for thousands of years. The earliest known lunar calendars are from 5,000 years ago in Mesopotamia. There is archaeological evidence that humans were tracking lunar phases as early as 30,000 years ago. In actuality, the moon is slowly receding from Earth. On a timescale of years, the distance is negligible, about 1.5 inches per year, or the rate at which fingernails grow. During the Apollo missions, astronauts placed highly reflective mirrors on the surface of the moon. For more than 50 years, scientists have been firing lasers at these mirrors from Earth and measuring how long it takes the beams to make the round-trip journey. They have found that the time is very minutely increasing, indicating that the distance between Earth and the Moon is increasing. It is well known that the Moon's gravitational effects on Earth results in ocean tides. What is less known is that the friction caused by the tides slows down Earth's rotation. Earth and the Moon are part of the same interacting spinning system, and in spinning systems, angular momentum must be conserved. There are two factors that influence angular momentum: how fast an object is spinning, and how far an object is from the center of the system. Because Earth's rotation is slowing down, something else must happen to the Earth-Moon system to make up for the loss of angular momentum. The Moon is drifting farther away from the center of the system, which increases angular momentum, offsetting what is lost by Earth's slowing rotation. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for future Star Talk segments, my email address is startalk@farmandcountry.org. For Farm and Country and Star Talk, this has been Keith Hubbard reminding you to keep looking up.
Thanks so much to Keith for that report. Well, the annual Trout Release Day is a fun, lively day for conservationists, children, and residents as trout are released into open waters for the first time. Farm and Country's Rosie Starr joined a group of Sullivan West students at the Calicoon Creek Park as they released young trout into the waters.
So I'm Sandy Anstrom, and I am a fifth grade teacher. I teach ELA, which is English Language Arts, and Social Studies this year. And this is our annual fifth grade trout day. It's just something that we do as part of our science curriculum. We start in October and we go to the DeBruce Fish Hatchery. We tour the hatchery and we get eggs, and then the kids raise the trout from eggs. We watch them develop over the school year. They learn about pH levels and how to care for them and water temperature. And then in May, we come down here to Houston Park and we release the trout. And we have all these wonderful presenters from the community join us. And we talk about water safety and, you know, activities to do on the river and in the lakes around here. And we just try to educate the children on all the wonderful things about our area and try to get them to be a part of the community.
Mm-hmm. How do you think that this program benefits the wider community of the watershed?
That's a good question. I think getting the kids out in nature is incredibly important, and teaching them like living off the land and taking care of our waters and our environment is wonderful. When we have the dive team come, you know, that's also a volunteer organization, and it kind of helps them to understand about giving back to the community and getting an interest in that kind of stuff. And then we, you know, we have the National Park Service, which does several presentations throughout elementary and gets the kids to understand what they're all about. And, you know, it's also a possible job opportunity for them also.
Mm-hmm. So you're going to be releasing a trout in just a few minutes. You're going to get one or two fish in a cup. They've had a stressful morning. We're going to make sure that we carry it from the bottom with our hand on top, because fish aren't happy in this little cup. They're not happy in the pool either. But we don't want to trip on the way. Don't be frightened if they come up and tap your finger. Not trying to bite you. They're just figuring out what's going on. So you walk down and you'll gently do this and let it swim out. You don't want to... Right. So that will come in a minute. In the meantime, you're going to be collecting some data. So you and a partner, who you'll determine in a minute, are going to be putting on your names, the date, a couple questions of observation. What color is the water? Can you see the bottom? Observational things throughout this whole sheet. Look up. Sometimes we see an eagle here. Very often we see an eagle here. So you're going to be taking the temperature. You know, of course, that this part has to be in the cold water and then leave it be for a little bit so you get a reading. What's the perfect temperature that you're hoping to get in Fahrenheit degrees, just based on what your tank was? Right, in the 50s, good. And I'm assuming that we'll have something in the 50s. We've had a lot of rain, so.
Usually it's like 56.
That'd be perfect. Okay, so you'll write that down, whatever it happens to be. Then you're going to be taking the pH. So you're going to take the solution. How many drops?
Three
drops. Put the cap on, give it a little shake. Hold it right up to the card. If you hold it out here, it can look a little different than the card. Hold it right on the card and you'll get a more accurate reading. What is perfect that we hope?
6.8.
6 8/10 would be good. 7 is actually perfect. If it's a little below or a little above, that's okay. You know how that happens in the classroom. Happens here too with rain, maybe. So we'll see what's here. We don't quite know yet. Nobody's reported back necessarily. So that will happen second after you release your fish. Right now, another class has those kits, so when they bring them back, you and your partner will grab a clipboard and a kit. Any questions before you get your trout?
So, guys, if you can repeat back, how are you going to hold the cup when you have the fish in it? Bella? Bottom and top. Don't get nervous if they start moving around in there. Are you dumping the cup out to let the fish into the creek?
No.
Let the fish swim out on its own. And then tell it goodbye and that you love him.
Goodbye,
and
Timmy.
I hope he makes it.
What if it's Timmy?
Timmy. Jay Tommy. Come back up. You can get your clipboard.
When the other class will be
up. Yeah, when you're done, make sure you bring the card.
Yes, guys, we're going to bring those cups back. We reuse them.
Reduce, reuse, recycle.
Older than the hills, right?
All right, get those fishies in the water. Walking it. It's a goodbye.
Bye, Timmy. Bye.
Here, the water's gonna be even colder than this.
Yes. I'm fine with that.
I wanna fall in.
No, you don't. That's very super cold. Shallow.
I'm gonna miss Tim.
You named him Tim?
Yeah, little Tim.
Bye, little Tim.
Is that a microphone?
Would you like to tell me about what's in your cup?
a giant fish who ate all the food.
He's giant? How big is he?
I don't know.
The fish got shocked a little bit.
Probably like 2 inches.
I present to you Timmy and Jim Bob.
Oh, Timmy and Jimmy, you've got two fish in there. Are they twins? They are?
Yeah.
What kind of fish are they?
Brown trout.
My little baby.
Your little babies. Why do you think they're your little babies? Because you helped them grow up. Do you remember when they were little eggs?
Yeah, I do.
I think you're one of the teachers.
Yes.
When did these eggs arrive?
We went to the hatchery in DeBruce in October and picked up our eggs. Each classroom got about 100 to 150. They gave us a nice tour of the hatchery, told us kind of how their program works. And it's just to help the kids really experience something real life. And we've been taking care of them since October in our classroom. And the kids have been feeding them and making sure their temperature's right, testing the pH, and doing things to help take care of them. And I feel like they just take a lot of responsibility and are very enthusiastic about learning about them. We also did a digital trout notebook on their computer where they did all kinds of research and took pictures and showed their learning. So it's just really exciting and a good experience for them for real life.
I lost my baby.
Are you putting him in, didn't you?
I miss him already.
You're part of Trout Unlimited, Pam Reinhart. What has inspired you to be so dedicated to Trout Unlimited?
Well, you know, when the program was introduced to us 18 years ago, I was like, oh my God, I said to my husband, we have to get this into Sullivan West. And I grabbed the president of the chapter at that time, and we went and did a presentation. We can do two tanks. And the two fifth grade teachers within 30 seconds of hearing of this program wanted it. And that's where it began. And it was just a way to bring the importance of how we need to preserve our cold water fisheries so that we constantly are able to get out there, fish, catch, release. And we want the students to learn the whole cycle from raising them from the eggs right on up to the release. They learn a lot of different things, and it's an amazing program.
And it's probably a lot easier to teach children when they're having fun.
Yes, and they love today. I mean, they're out with nature, but they're learning. They're not just releasing the fish into the water. They're checking their temperatures. They're making sure the pH of the water is in good condition. So it's just a wonderful program, and they incorporate so much. They do math where they'll figure out how many eggs are really in the little container when they pick them up from the hatchery, to doing artwork, to writing poems, to writing music. It's just a wonderful opportunity to introduce them to what is just natural to our area. The parents feel it's important that their children are learning this and that we're offering them another way to be out there in nature, but not only just to fish, but to keep our fisheries clean. They learn that the water flows from all over, and it's not just here we have to keep clean, but we have to keep it clean further upstream and downstream. We have to make sure these waters are healthy, and that's what's important.
Trout Unlimited member Rick Latornis patiently attends the display and description of colorful fly ties.
Just showing them how to tie green inchworms, ants that float, and beetles that float. All pretty simple patterns.
And I'm touching all the hooks with my hands.
We've got a rowdy crowd here today.
This is radio, so we have to be very descriptive. Tell me what this is that you're looking at.
A grasshopper.
Is it a real grasshopper?
No, not a real grasshopper.
It's like orange.
It's bait.
And black and brown and green. It's got a hook at the bottom.
It's got an orange on the top back. And then like,
what does that mean, that fish eat grasshoppers?
Some
do.
But the most common is the bugs that go on top of the water.
What color is that ant?
It's a black ant.
So it looks like a real ant.
This is a brown ant.
To me, these bigger baits kind of represent dragonflies.
Yeah, like what? Do you look like dragonflies? Like,
oh, wait. Thank you!
I'm going to take
a
video really quick.
You're a great crowd.
I've been with Trout Unlimited for, oh my goodness, 35 years or more.
And I do fly tying demonstrations. And I'm a fisherman. We're all fishermen, including Pam and all the other folks here. So a large part of what we do is conservation. We can't do enough to teach our youth about conservation. Clean water is extremely important. And releasing these trout brings the children very, very close to the clean water. This is a wonderful thing that folks do here.
Trout Unlimited member Peter Kolasar shares his inspired dedication about the program Trout in the Classroom.
It's a way for the children to connect to so many things. In the classroom, they're raising these little fish from eggs and watching that whole biology and learning about the requirements for the fish and their pH and the temperature and the food and all of that. That's happening in the classroom in kind of a laboratory session. And then they come out here in the river and they're doing the same thing. They're releasing the fish, they're measuring the water temperature, they're measuring the pH. So it's a whole connection to the world of biology and the world of nature. And then we do a little bit of this fishing demonstration to them, hopefully connects them to being out here and enjoying the wilderness. It's a total package, something coming together and joyful. You feel the kids are having a great time, and we old geezers are having a good time too, you know.
Well, you're sage. You may be becoming senior in age, but you're sage and wise.
Oh, thank you for saying that.
Hello.
Hello, Andy.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm bumping into your session over here.
Okay.
I want to hear what you're saying to this young man.
What we're saying is that we're using a fly rod, which is a specialized piece of equipment, to toss a very light fly a distance that it normally wouldn't go. So we use a heavy fly line to project the fly out in the air with a back cast backwards and then a cast to the target where the fish is feeding. Joseph, you're going to bring this to your ear smartly and fast, like this, and then to the target. Give that a try. That's it, and then forward. These young warriors of our streams, these are the people that are in the next generation that are going to speak up for the river, speak up for the fishies. The fishies have no voice, so we need to speak for them by our actions.
Who would like to try to describe what's going on here today?
We are doing a trout release day, and we are releasing fish, and we're doing other groups about fish.
Okay, and where did these fish come from?
We got them from a fish place where the other fish like have babies, and we brought them to our classroom and we raised them until we had to release them because they got big.
We got them.
Well, how does it feel to let go of something you've taken care of for so long?
It's like sad because it feels like they were starting to like become our like animal friends because we raised them, we fed them, we checked the water and like stuff like that.
I'm going to miss Billy, Jimmy, Bob, Penelope, and Jill. Those are all my fishes.
Well, you named good names for them.
Thank you.
I had one that was named Fatty because I had the biggest fish in the whole thing.
How much did it weigh? How big was it?
It was probably this big, and it was probably this fat. It was really fat and really big.
I did not see any fish that were 6 inches long coming out of those cups. Now, is that a big fish story? Are you giving me a fish tale?
You can ask her.
I legit saw it. It was like this big, bro.
They're kind of like our pets. And then we had to let them go, which is really sad, because then we don't get to see them anymore. And they were kind of our pets.
Well, did you write a little story about them or write a poem or a song? That way you can remember them and have them with you forever.
To remember the fish, we did a little PowerPoint that looked like it was on Book Creator. And we were doing things like that to see and like learn about how the fish, what we saw, what we examined, and we drew a picture of what was in the fish tank. And we examined them a lot. We watched them when they first were hatching out of their eggs. We wrote about that, and that's really all we have.
So anybody want to talk about how it felt to let go of their fish today in the water?
I feel like it was really sad because like we've had them since they were little eggs.
So it's going to be hard to get used to them not being in the classroom.
Okay. This morning, I looked back and I saw the fish tank and the fish were not there. So, like, everything was still running. The light was on. The pump was still going. It was still, like, filtering everything, too. And
did you have a hard time this winter? It was really cold. We had a very cold winter. Was it hard to maintain the fish tank properly?
No, it wasn't really that hard because we had a pump, and our teacher is a really good fish reporter, and she kept checking the PA or whatever it's called to make sure that the fish were doing good. And if that wasn't, like, if it wasn't doing good, they would tell the janitor, or they would call somebody that, like, was a fish service person, and they would talk about how they would get the fish better. But since there was a heater and the classroom stayed warm during the winter, there was no problem taking care of them.
Yeah, like she said, there was a heater and the pH my teacher checked all the time. And so basically, it really wasn't that hard.
Okay, so tell me what the pH is in the water.
In this water here?
Well, in the tank. What does the pH mean in the tank?
How warm the water is and if it's safe for the fish and stuff.
Thank you. You guys are wonderful. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much to Rosie for that very, very sweet and cute report. Well, before we sign off, we have an update on the debate to manage growing crowds at Catterskill Falls and Catterskill Cove, which is one of the Catskills' most heavily visited destinations. Radio Catskills' Tim Bruno spoke with Jeff Centerman. He's executive director of the Catskill Center, who submitted formal comments to New York's Department of Conservation, urging the state to prioritize staffing, infrastructure improvements, and visitor education before considering permits or caps on access. Here's some of that conversation.
What prompted Catskill Center to submit these formal comments on the Catterskill Cove Visitor Use Management Report at this stage of the process?
The Catskill Center, we've been an environmental organization that's been working to protect and preserve the Catskills region for over 50 years now. And so really anytime there are opportunities for us to engage with either the state or the city or whatever entity is doing something in the Catskills, we try to get ourselves involved. We have a long history of working in Catterskill Cove with the town of Hunter, with the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. We were part of DEC's committee that called for the use of visitor use management to look at Catterskill Falls. So we are happy that the state has invested in this process. It is a process that is used throughout the country and by the federal government to manage recreation and natural resource protection on their lands. However, we think that the report that came out missed the mark a little bit in that it really focused on limiting use as opposed to many of the other improvements and actions that could be taken on site that have been recommended for many years. And so our comment letter really focuses on looking at all of those alternatives before we get to restricting use through a permit system or a timed entry system.
Why do you think those measures that the visitor use management framework recommends on visitor caps or permits are premature?
Really, because in all honesty, the department has made some improvements at Catterskill Falls, but there are a vast number that can be made, including increasing visitor information, education, the enforcement throughout the entire Clove area, parking enforcement. Increased infrastructure improvements, so more trails, more parking, more signage, and better ways to get people to flow throughout Catterskill Cove. There was a shuttle system that was being operated by a private individual. That shuttle service is no longer in operation, but we continue to support and believe that a well-functioning, well-supported, both likely public and privately funded shuttle system is key to ensuring that folks get into our communities, both at the top and the bottom. So parking in Palinville or parking in Tannersville, and then getting on shuttles and visiting the site, and then having a trail network that once someone gets off a shuttle, they can get back to another shuttle spot and then eventually back to their car over on a main street in Tannersville or Palinville.
Ask you a little bit more about infrastructure and transportation access. What are some of the biggest physical challenges right now at Catterskill Clove?
For the whole Clove, parking is really one of the biggest issues, and access to many of the popular swimming holes and sites along Route 23A as it makes its way up from Palinville into Haines Falls. Right now, understandably, as part of when the shuttle was launched, all parking within the Clove was cut off. And so the only way to get into the Clove along 23A was either to take a shuttle or to walk. Now that the shuttle is not there, people continue to want to access that area. So these last few warm days, we've already seen folks parking both at the top by the Mountaintop Historical Society and down at the bottom by the Harding Road trailhead and walking on 23A, which you can imagine is quite a busy vehicle road. And having pedestrians on a road not designed for pedestrians is dangerous both for those folks walking and for the people driving vehicles.
Are there examples, are there examples from other parks or tourism areas that could serve as a model for a shuttle system?
I think that if you visit many of our national parks, there are very good shuttle systems that are running. In Acadia specifically, there's a shuttle service that is run by the Park Service, but it's supported by L.L. Bean also, and along with private business in Bar Harbor and that area. And it's kind of a comprehensive shuttle that brings folks both to sites that are in the national park, but also bring you to the different main streets, both in Bar Harbor and in other communities on Mount Desert Island. That was one of the shuttle systems that when we were working with the department prior to this report, that was used as a model for the report that was made recommending this VUM report.
You mentioned Route 23A. Transportation and parking have long been concerns along that route. Your comments also discuss real-time visitor communication. What kinds of systems or technology would help reduce congestion and improve safety for people even before they arrive?
We think that there's some really simple ways, very low-tech, that the simplest could be a repeating AM station. Often when you are approaching parks, you see a sign that says tune into, you know, station X in order to get information about the spot. That would be sort of a very low barrier way to do that. Variable messaging boarding that is designed in a way to match the aesthetic of the scenic byway there and of the Clove itself. So as folks are approaching Palinville, coming up from Saugerties and the Thruway, they could be getting real-time information about conditions in the Clove. Like, if it's a Saturday, most of the signs will probably say, you know, all parking lots are full, continue to wherever we're trying to direct folks. And then also the parking lots themselves having systems in place right now at Laurel House and at Scott Road, which are the two major parking lots at the top of Catterskill Falls. There are people who have to kind of drag sandwich boards out to say that the parking lot is full and, you know, have to, you know, keep going back and forth. Having some smart technology, whether that's the variable messaging board or whatever it ends up being, but being able to in a more real time and not relying on whether someone can get away from managing traffic in order to put a sandwich board at the end of the entrance would be much more helpful and just would be able to direct folks around. And also, you know, putting all that information into a real-time app. So if folks are visiting, they can get all that information in one place and know whether today is a good day to visit Catterskill Falls or maybe they should visit somewhere else in the Catskills and come back on a slower day or come back later in the afternoon, whatever that might be.
And you can catch that full interview on our website at wjffradio.org. That's all for this week's show. If you are in the area, come on down to our music yard sale happening right now until 3 p.m. at our studios in Liberty. We're indoors and we have so much good stuff priced to move. Thanks to Ronald for help producing this show. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
Support comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, fighting for clean air, land, and water since 2008, both locally and beyond. Information online at their Main Street storefront in Narrowsburg or their office in the Narrowsburg Union. DamascusCitizens.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.